You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. Today on Groundwire.
There's at least six people that are currently in on a hunger strike for about 28 days, and then there's going to be more people.
If you ignore what you read in the Telegraph Journal and the Irving Dome Press, you get a very different picture.
I mean, this is what these deals are meant to do. When the government is putting up, you know, it's put on display, it's put in the window.
Hello, and welcome to the November 4th, 2013 edition of Groundwire. I'm Kim Hornack. Groundwire is a grassroots community news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. All episodes of Groundwire are available for listening or podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. Today on Groundwire, we will hear features on Canada's comprehensive economic trade agreement with the European Union and coverage of the migrant strike at the Central East Correctional Center. But first, community news headlines. Throughout the month of October, National Energy Board hearings about the reversal of Line 9 have been taking place in both Montreal and Toronto. Protesters have been present every day of the hearings in both cities. Indigenous communities along the route of the pipeline have been mobilizing and speaking out against the Line 9 reversal for many months. The Line 9 reversal would transport bitumen from the tar sands from Sarnia to Montreal. At a protest in Montreal on October 10th, 32 people were arrested. Amanda Lickers, an Indigenous woman and one of the spokespeople for the protest, shared her opposition to Line 9 with the media co-op. Quote, "Both the reversal of Line 9 and the construction of the Trans-Canada Energy East Pipeline are nothing but the continuation of the slow industrial genocide known as the tar sands. Pipeline projects rely on the theft of Indigenous lands and they are guaranteed to spill. Enbridge is an imperial entity directly threatening the health of our land and our waters, and they must be stopped." End quote. The hearings continued on October 18th in Toronto, and a number of Indigenous warriors stormed the hearings in solidarity with Elsa Puktuk, who had been raided and attacked by the RCMP earlier that day. A statement was released saying that Enbridge's closing arguments scheduled for the following day at the NEB hearing would be postponed due to security concerns. And now for an update on the case of Mr. Majoub. On Friday, October 25th, Justice Blanchard ruled that the security certificate that Mr. Majoub has been held under for 13 years is reasonable. Mina Ramos from CFRU brings us an interview with Victoria Barnett from the Justice for Majoub Network.
Mr. Majoub came to Canada in 1995 and was accepted as a refugee the next year. And then since June of 2000, he's been held under a security certificate, and he's been held indefinitely without any charge or trial. And basically what has happened since then, for much of that time, he was held either in prison, so he was in Toronto Metro West Detention Center for about 6 years, some of that in solitary confinement, and he was also held for 2 years in Kingston at the Guantanamo North Detention Center, and then the rest of that time he's been held under house arrest. And I guess during the time when he was in prison, he did hunger strikes and various protests on the different situations that he was facing. And just recently, a lot of his conditions were removed. And I'm saying recently, it was about a year ago now. Last week was, it was the rulings on Mohammed's case the judge issued on Friday, last Friday, October 25th, was that Mohammed's security certificate was found to be reasonable. The motion for stay of proceedings, which is based on charter violations, was only granted in part. So what was recognized was that Mr. Majoub's right to a fair trial was violated, and that his right to protection from abusive search was violated, but they refused to order any other remedy for that, and everything else as part of that was dismissed. And the constitutional challenges to the security certificate law, which Majoub and his lawyers put forth, and the CSIS Act, were both dismissed.
The fight to stop shale gas exploration continues in New Brunswick. Many communities, environmental groups, and activists are banding together to stop the provincial government from allowing more seismic testing to take place in the province. One of the efforts, No Shale Gas NB, is currently raising funds to have a court injunction put on fracking. Chris from Hampton Water First spoke with CFMH about the legal battle they are hoping to start and what gives him hope in the continuing struggle against shale gas.
There are a large number of people, individuals and groups in the province, and Hampton Water First was by no means the first that got involved. There are, over the last 2 years, been an evolution and various structures created to coordinate the activities of the 30-odd groups that are involved in the struggle against shale gas. And so one of the proposals that Hampton Water First put forward to the provincial groups was the idea of a fundraising effort to raise money to bring a legal action against the government, to ask the courts for an injunction to halt the shale gas activity on the basis of the fact that this project by the government, these actions by the government, are very likely to bring about harm to our environment, harm to our societies, and harm to our water. Mm-hmm. And MB Water First is a body that is being formed and will be incorporated, and that's the body that will take the action to court. What gives us hope is the support that we get from the general public. So there's a, if you only read the Telegraph Journal every morning, you would get a very different picture mm-hmm. of what the mood and sentiment is in New Brunswick and the likelihood of us winning the battle. If you ignore what you read in the Telegraph Journal and the Irving Dawn Press, you get a very different picture. So if you're standing on the side of the road with a sign in Sussex, as we were last Friday, you see enormous amount of support from the people who are driving by. And if you look at the people from all walks of life and all kinds of backgrounds who were at the protests in Rexton and Route 126 this summer, you see that there's a very wide swath of the population of New Brunswick, the general public, who firmly believe that this is a bad idea and we don't want to go down this road. And that's what keeps us going, provides the energy to keep up the fight.
To learn more about the injunction and to donate, visit noshalegasnb.ca. You are listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast. And now for our feature stories. And now for an update on the migrant strike that's continuing at the Central East Correctional Center. Nearly 200 migrants are being held indefinitely in the maximum security provincial prison in Lindsay, Ontario. Several of the hunger-striking migrants have recently been moved to segregation. At least two of the hunger-striking migrants in segregation have reported that they are vomiting blood. There have also been reports that the Canadian Border Services Agency has been deporting several of the striking migrants. Josh Gilbert from the End Immigration Detention Network interviewed Martin Sisse and Linville Daly, two migrants who are currently hunger-striking and imprisoned in the segregation unit on October 19th.
My name is Martin. The last name is Sisse. I've been on segregation for 10 days now, and I've been on hunger strike for 28 days. I've been in Lindsay for 28 months, actually. There's at least six people that are currently in on a hunger strike for about 28 days, and then it's going to be more people because people are really frustrated. Detained, and they're waiting to get my travel documents, which is not going to be, obtained, because my country, the Gambia, is known to be one of the countries that don't issue travel documents. So I'm pleading for the Canadian public to help in this situation, you know. And it's not just me that's currently under detention and in segregation. There's about an next five people that are on hunger strike as long as I have. Lyndall Daly.
This is my fellow. We're both down here together. We both come off the same unit. And we've been on hunger strike ever since. 28 days. I started off at 250. I've lost 50 pounds. I'm from Jamaica, and Jamaica's refusing to give any travel documents because I've been out of the country too long. I came here when I was 7. So I've been in Canada for 43 years, and I have one criminal offense, and that was a manslaughter. And I brought people bail me out. The minister has also recommended their program, but for some reason I'm being ignored. Jamaica will not give any documents because I do not have any family back there. All my family is here in Canada. They're watching my medication because I got high blood pressure. and back pains, So just keeping an eye on my meds and taking my weight and taking my blood pressure. That's all I'm doing. But I'm just getting weak and dizzy slowly, and, you know, it's just lots of liquid. I'm just drinking water and juice. Right now, they're just making us bathe every 2 days. We came down here. We didn't get a shower for like 6 days. We're on segregation. We haven't done anything wrong. We're just trying to stay to point to immigration to make a stand that we've been here. It's almost 3 years that I've been on immigration trying to get this out. So they've been trying to get my documents from Jamaica for 3 years. So I don't know why I'm on segregation. Jamaica refused to give them any travel documents, so they bring us to segregation. That's not right.
This is Martin Cisse again. This hunger strike, we're going to keep this up. We're going to keep it up. If it needs 100 days, we're going to do it because we need our freedom. If Canada cannot get us out of Canada, they need to release us so they can get us out. So we are taking a stand, and we want immigration to know what's going on. We want the public to contact Immigration Canada. We need the Canadian public to put pressure on the immigration minister so they can stop this lengthy and cruel and unusual detentions. People have been here waiting for 32 months to get on a flight. I've been waiting for 28 months to get on a flight. I am no criminal. I've done my time in Canada. My criminal conviction have been served, and I've been detained for 28 months waiting to get on a flight. The media is putting coverage on jail conditions. We are not fighting for jail conditions. We are fighting for our freedom, for our lives out there. We have family, we have kids in Canada that can't see us because we've been detained for 28 months, 32 months. This is what we're fighting for. We could care less about the jail conditions. First of all, we shouldn't be in jail. Never mind the conditions. This is indefinite hold. This is illegal. This should be illegal. You cannot take me to my country. You can't put me in jail. And it's an indefinite detention because every month I go for my detention review, and it's the same thing. It's like a cycle. It never stops. As long as the minister has something to hang on, the immigration division member is going to detain us for the next month. We have families, man. We have Canadian citizens. Our kids were born in this land. Yes, I have a family. I have a daughter. That's 4 years old, Canadian citizen.
On October 23rd, Mike Omogo filed a complaint with the Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions at the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, demanding an end to his indefinite detention. He has been in detention for 7 years. If he succeeds in forcing Canada to establish a presumptive period, indefinite immigration detention could end. Over the past 4 years, the Harper government has been in negotiations with the European Union over the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement, or CETA. In the past 2 weeks, little information has been released in regards to the details of the deal. I spoke with Stuart True, the trade campaigner for Council of Canadians, about the deal and what concerns Canadians should have regarding CETA. Hi, Stuart. My first question is in regards to secrecy of the negotiations. At this time, no pages of the agreement have been made public. Is this a natural element of trade deals, or does it present a reason for the public to raise its collective eyebrow?
I would say it's normal but not natural for these kinds of trade and investment negotiations to happen completely in secret. There have been times in the past where trade documents have been put online, like every country's negotiating position, for example, in the free trade area of the Americas, which was another very large trade negotiation between the countries of this hemisphere, of North and South America. All those negotiating texts were eventually put online so people could see what was in the deal. That was, of course, because of a lot of public pressure in all the countries to see the agreement, to make sure it wasn't happening in secret. But the sad fact is that since then, these free trade deals that countries have signed happen in secret. They are only made public when there's a final deal, when it's been signed. And after that point, there is nothing we can do to change it. So it's not just an undemocratic process. It's an anti-democratic process. It's on purpose so that no one can have any say in what the deal looks like, except, of course, the corporate lobby groups that are involved the entire way in deciding what the text should look like. I mean, these are very much deals written by and for corporations, where there is no room at all after they're finished for the people, for our legislative assemblies at any level to have any say.
It seems as though this trade agreement, like NAFTA, is for corporate protection while it infringes on Canadians to have the opportunity to say what happens in their country in regards to environmental and social policies. Is this an accurate assessment or too severe of a reaction?
No, it's completely accurate. I mean, this is what these deals are meant to do. When the government is putting up, you know, it's put on display, it's put in the window, you know, the benefits to the beef sector or the fishing sector, or perhaps, you know, that we've seen cheese put in the window to make Canadians excited about this deal. That is like one fraction, 1% of what this deal is actually about. It's essentially a corporate legal constitution for corporations, essentially. It's a massive 1,000-page document on what governments can't do, what they can't do to protect the environment, what they can't do to create jobs and support sustainable development. And that is, so it's exactly, it's not a too stern definition of what these deals do. The government will say that these investment protections allow for governments to introduce new environmental policies, but it's simply not true. It's very misleading. You can introduce policies as long as they don't interfere with the investment treaty. I mean, it's very clear that what comes first in these deals is trade flows, investment flows, and only policies that corporations can live with, essentially, make it through unscathed. The most serious effect of these deals on our governments is that they put a chill on public policy. They create kind of uncertainty about what governments can do to protect the environment. So the tendency is that they hold back. They don't want to introduce new policies that are going to really reduce emissions because they're afraid that they're going to get sued in a trade dispute or in an investment dispute. These investment disputes happen, you know, in a hotel room somewhere or behind closed doors, essentially. The government admits that these treaties put a chill on policy, and that's why it wants to protect financial policy from investor to state lawsuits. It says that if we expose our financial regulations to that kind of threat, it's going to make us hesitant to respond in the case of a crisis. So if they admit that, you know, there's a significant impact and puts a chill on governments at the financial level, then they know that it does the same at the environmental policy level. And I think on purpose, they hope it puts that chill in that sector, because in the case of this government, in the Harper government, they want to be able to get things out of the ground, you know, the tar sands, oil, gas, mining. This is their modus operandi. This is what they see this deal as doing, is making it more difficult to get in the way of tar sands and other projects, and to make it impossible for Europe to do the same, to be able to stop Canadian mining companies from digging where they want to in Europe, make it impossible for Europe to stop tar sands from entering the market, for example, through the Fuel Quality Directive. Mm-hmm. And very much these deals are a direct barrier in the way of our addressing climate change, I think.
I was curious as to if the Council of Canadians has an idea of how people within the European Union feel about the deal, especially since some of the countries are more progressive towards addressing climate change than Canada. It seems as though this deal could work against some of the policies countries already have or are working to have that address climate change.
Well, for a while, it felt like in Europe, I mean, this deal was flying completely under the radar. There was no issue for people. They thought Canada was a country that had the same kind of high standards as Europe, and there was no danger of undermining labor rights, for example, in Canada. Mm-hmm. But people quickly realized that, in fact, there's a lot of opposition. There's a lot of concern about how this deal is going to affect European environmental policy. So we talked about the Fuel Quality Directive, which is an attempt to reduce the carbon content of transportation fuels by 2020, by about 6% by 2020. And we know that the Harper government has been lobbying very hard against that, saying it's discriminatory, saying it's a trade barrier. So people in Europe are now very tuned in to that threat that this deal could put on environmental policy. They're also tuned in to the threat that the investment protection chapter will have on countries that want to put a moratorium or completely ban fracking, hydraulic fracturing, or shale gas extraction. Mm-hmm. And this has really, I think, created a lot of opposition within the European Parliament, within European environmental organizations, trade justice organizations, who will be now watching this deal much more closely and resisting some of these worst aspects of it. Mm-hmm. There's obviously from the beginning been issues in Europe related to their consumer product policies. So we know that they don't like eating meat that's been treated with hormones or antibiotics, and they don't like meat that's been washed with lactic acid or chemicals, as is the normal process in the NAFTA and North American region. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at these deals as a way that Canada and then the United States, because of course the U.S. is negotiating a similar deal with the European Union, mm-hmm. How their own regulations are going to be undermined by these two treaties. So what was once maybe not so much on the radar mm-hmm. is now very much there, and groups are actively pushing to, at the very least, to take out the investment protection chapter, because they can see that it's just going to mean tons of lawsuits against their own environmental policies.
How can Canadians get involved or have their concerns over the deal heard?
Well, there's a number of things people can do on our website at canadians.org. We have a CETA page where we have several actions. You can be writing your provincial politicians right away, your provincial member of the legislature, and saying that you do want a review, that you don't accept that this deal can be negotiated in secret and then signed without our approval. So there's tools to help you do that on our site. We want to go back to municipalities and say there's no reason for you to be bound by these rules on public spending, because this isn't a matter of trade. This is simply a matter of large European corporations bidding on and winning more contracts than Canadian small and medium-sized enterprises or local companies. This is really just a way to kind of siphon public money, which could have gone to enriching the community, mm-hmm. siphon it into the hands of very large multinational companies who will be picking up more contracts, expect to pick up many more contracts in this deal. So we want to go back to cities and say, this is not in your interest to be included in this deal. And we really are encouraging the federal government to just walk away from CETA. I mean, that's one of our main actions. We think we know enough about the deal already from leaked texts that we can say it's not in Canada's best interest and we should be walking away. So I would say, there's a number of things people can do. There's petitions on the site they can sign. But really, this is, I think, about localizing the fight now. We need to be getting the message out in our community to our friends and family and colleagues, and we need to be pushing back at the provincial level for some kind of democratic process here.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me, Stuart. To learn more about Council of Canadians and to read some of Stuart True's writing, you can visit canadians.org. Aaron Lakoff is one of the producers involved in the collaborative radio documentary series Confronting the Pipe Dream. Aaron shared with Groundwire some of his insights on the project and what has surprised and inspired him while doing the radio series.
We have about a dozen segments that are planned right now. It's kind of an open project in the sense that we're hoping that the website, which is confrontingthepipedream.com, can kind of be a platform for different people to use to upload audio from different points of resistance and different communities who are struggling against pipelines. So for the first part, we've of course just been focusing a lot on Indigenous voices, because we feel really strongly that it's Indigenous people who are not only at the forefront of people who are negatively impacted by pipelines, but also at the forefront of people who are fighting back. And we've seen, again, those incredibly inspiring struggles in Wet'suwet'en territory, in Six Nations, in Amjanong First Nation, indigenous communities in Maine and Vermont who are fighting back. So we really wanted to put that, you know, first and foremost. But of course, we have interviews that are coming up with people from the Texas tar sands blockade and the Great Plains tar sands resistance in Utah. So people should just keep checking that website, confrontingthepipedream.com, and there'll probably be more episodes going up over the next coming months. I think one of the biggest surprises that I encountered working on this series is just seeing again how we can take forces and phenomenon that we see as being, you know, really negative to our communities and to our planet, like pipelines, but also seeing again the possibilities that are there and the possibilities in fighting back and how fighting back actually creates communities of struggle and of solidarity, just like radio creates communities. And I think that these projects that also unite different radio stations and different people across the FM are really powerful, because it gives us this chance to take these voices and to amplify them, not only on one or two radio stations, but on several different ones. And, you know, we've had messages rolling in of different radio stations across Turtle Island who've been airing the series and different segments in the series. So that's been something really encouraging. And then another thing that I wouldn't say it surprises me, but just always encourages me, is the power of voices who are speaking out around this issue. So many incredibly inspiring young people are coming to the forefront. You know, people who, when I meet them, I just feel like it's an absolute honor and a privilege to be able to sit down and talk with them and hear their voices. People like Vanessa Gray, who is a young activist from the Omgenang First Nation in Southern Ontario, who we did an interview with out at the Una Stone Action Camp, or Amanda Lickers, who's a Seneca activist who's been very active around Enbridge's Line 9. And, you know, just seeing how there's this new generation coming up of Indigenous people who are so steadfast and determined to stop these pipelines, I think that's a really incredible thing. And you hear that passion and you hear that energy conveyed in the interviews in this series.
To listen to, download, or learn more about Confronting the Pipe Dream, visit confrontingthepipedream.com. That does it for this edition of Groundwire, a bi-weekly non-profit national news program produced by the community for the community. Groundwire is heard on dozens of campus and community radio stations across the country. This month's edition was produced at CFMH on Maliseet Territory in St. John, New Brunswick. My name is Kim Hornack, and I've been your host and producer. Special thanks to Carly Forbes for all her help. To learn more about Groundwire, visit Groundwire online at groundwire.ncra.ca. Or get in touch by email at groundwire@ncra.ca. Thanks for listening.